Honestly Unbalanced.
Welcome to episode 104 of Honestly Unbalanced, where we chat to people that have tried to make your life a little bit better. Our guest this week is Sarah Ezrin, who I first met in London, I think about 10 years ago. She's the author of the award-winning The Yoga of Parenting and is a highly sought-after yoga educator. She's been teaching all over for so long. She's a content creator and a maternal mental health advocate based in the San Francisco Bay Area. Her words, teachings, and social media are all designed to be supportive, healing sources for people that want to be seen and people that want to be heard. In this episode, we chat about being authentic versus being popular and the battle that goes on between those two poles, if they need to even be poles. The post-COVID evolution of the yoga industry, a little discussion about the shift towards individualistic even life versus starting and creating a family. We talk about the needs to parent as a community and how to recognize moments of depletion and how to replenish yourself, and practical tips for parents and, to be honest, anyone else to incorporate grounding practices into their daily routines. Before the podcast gets fully started, I'm delighted to announce that Holly and I are running our first UK retreat together from the 21st to the 24th of June this year. It's in Dorset. It's about 2.5 hours, 3 hours from London by car, a little bit closer by train, I think. The venue is beautiful. We've persuaded them to let us host a yoga retreat there. They don't really do many of them. The venue is amazing. It's got an ice bath. It's got a sauna. It's got a pool. The accommodation is stunning. It's on these beautiful rolling hills. It feels like it's in the middle of nowhere. The yoga rooms that we can use for yoga, at least not dedicated yoga rooms, are stunning. It's going to be really special retreats, and the chef we have is going to provide the most incredible food. It's not the typical retreat food. If you go ahead to the website, you can check out the full menu, literally the whole menu that you're going to be experiencing while you're there. It's pretty nice. And in terms of activities, I'll be teaching lots of yoga, a little bit of breath work as well, some meditation. Holly's going to be doing sound journeys, of course. Imagine going to bed every night with basically Holly singing, tune playing, crystal bowls. And we're going to offer some mini workshops and facilitate like group walks. It's going to be a pretty special few days. So if you're up for it, head to adamhustler.com/Dorset, or you can just find it generally on my website. It's very easy to find. And if you fancy a yoga mat, I always love to shout out Lifeform. Code Hustler10 will get you a discount. And I think they have a special sale on at the moment, quite a big sale. And although that code Hustler10 will normally give you 10% off, in the sale, it will still give you an extra 5% off the sale price. So if you want a new yoga mat and you want one that will last a long time and actually be really good quality from a company that's wonderful to the world, head to Lifeform. Anyway, you guys enjoy the podcast now. Honestly Unbalanced. I read something that you quoted, Matty, or the late Matty Ezrati, and it struck a chord with me because I've been talking a lot about it in my trainings recently. This idea of you have to choose to some degree whether you want to be popular or you want to teach the kind of style you want to teach. And I'm butchering whatever she said, but it was more or less that. And that's, I think, very true in London at the moment. I know there were certain things I could do to make my class more popular. Firstly, probably get rid of a dad bod. That would be a factor. But forget that. Park that for a second. But if I played like more flamboyant music, if I taught at speed, etc., I know that in the current London climate would make for a more popular yoga class. Whereas I'm now, you know, teaching for so long, very much set in my ways, and I know the kind of yoga I want to teach and what I want people to get from their practice. And it isn't necessarily the most popular style, but luckily, financially, I still can make money through various means and through reputation. And that quote, I guess, is quite hard for people that want to teach how they want to teach, but they're not making the money. So they kind of need to get sucked into doing the other stuff. And so I just wondered if you could speak a little bit about both that quote, maybe what Matty means to you, and then how relevant you think that quote is to people at the beginning of their yoga journey or yoga teaching journey.
Well, it's a great question. And I know we're cutting into like the interview, wherever it is, but I just want to say thank you for having me. So thank you
for
having me
here
in your home. It's good to see you both. So the quote was, do you want to be popular or do you want to teach yoga? Mati, who was, I'm blessed to have been able to have called my teacher, and I still consider her my teacher, even though she's not with us earthside, had a vision over what yoga studios should be. She founded the very first Yoga Works in Los Angeles, which is where a number of the world's greatest teachers had their start. And then they kind of branched out and that influenced all around the world. But in Mati's mind, the studio was not a studio. It wasn't like it wasn't a place to go necessarily even to make money, which is none of them really do anyway. But she wanted it to be a school. She always wanted to call it a school. That was very, very important to her. Teaching yoga she always said it's a privilege to teach. And to have students is to be teaching them in this forum where they are willing to learn. For her, the commodification of it all was like blasphemous to everything. Now, unfortunately, like you say, like we have to make a living. And even the Vedas say like it's okay to earn living, to live, fulfill your dharma. But I think the root of what Mati was trying to say, and I remember when we had that talk and where it was coming from, was really like, don't sell your soul for the extra dollar. Trust that being authentic to you, you're going to get the right people. And like you say, well, you know, what do you do if what your soul is calling for you is very different than what's popular mm-hmm. in the city that you're teaching in or the location? And I had that happen here. I moved up to San Francisco, which was very fast flows. I came from Los Angeles where it was like, you know, holding Warrior II for 10 minutes mm-hmm. and working every single detail, to here where I was like, oh my gosh, we just did 30 poses in like 3 seconds, mm-hmm. you know? And so yes, I could have, I probably could have easily adopted the style that was around me, and perhaps my classes would have grown, or maybe the students would have sensed that it wasn't authentic to who I was. Like there's no guarantee, right? That just because I'm mimicking what's going mm-hmm. on around me, that that's going to be successful. But where I did see success, and let's maybe even redefine success, not as monetary, but more as being authentic and having a dedicated group of people that came and studied with me, is when I was teaching the type of yoga that I believed in. So it's, you know, I think the long and short of it is there is no guarantee that by copying what's quote unquote popular, you're even going to necessarily be successful. But where you will be most successful is in living authentically in what you're in alignment with. And the students notice that too, mm-hmm. right? They can sense that. They can sense, can I cuss on here?
Yeah, go wild.
Yeah, they can sense when you're bullshitting them, right? And you show up and you're just like rattling off poses, or and I've seen you teach, and Holly, I've heard you sing, like when you're in your truth, when you're in your dharma, there's some magic that's happening. Something is coming through you. And maybe there's a person that doesn't want to learn that way. And then, you know, bless them, they're going to find their right teacher. But success has to come from being authentic to who you are.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she meant.
I love that.
And the next layer to that, if you are trying to compete in a busy market, and you know, competing is a horrible idea in the yoga world, but you know, if you're trying to get the jobs and you are trying to get students to make money, then you can't compete with that by doing what everyone else is doing, especially not doing a bad version of what everyone else is doing. As you say, people will see through it, and you might get some more people temporarily, but actually there are so many people nowadays, thank goodness, that want to do yoga, whether they want to be yogis or just it's something part of their weekly schedule, that we're competing for actually a massive market, and we don't need that many people to like us in many sectors, to be honest, to actually make money from it. Really, do you? You don't need thousands of people to love you to make a living from teaching yoga.
Well, and I for the people that are listening, I'm definitely making faces. So biting my lip and I'm squeezing my cheeks. Okay. So again, we came up around similar times. So you all watched this in the beginning when I first started. So remember, like, for example, obviously yoga's been around since, you know, the Vedas are believed to have been first written down. This doesn't mean they weren't oral before that, you know, 1500 BC. So obviously there has been a practice of yoga. Asana was more like medieval period, et cetera. I don't need to give you the history of yoga. like when yoga became super popular and that big wellness bubble burst or began rather, I think we're kind of in the bursting of it, was like the 90s and the early 2000s. And if you remember, because there was less teachers, the teacher training machine hadn't really been pumping through, the popular teachers would have hundreds of people in their classes. I mean, hundreds. Vinnie Marino, who was a very well-known teacher and still has hundreds of people because he is a legend and is amazing in Los Angeles, would have people poured into the street at some of the studios. And I've been to some of the studios in London. I've seen that happening too. Now, the studios, right? And remember, Mati wanted it to be a school, and that was the original vision behind teacher trainings. But the studio started to see, well, you can get someone to pay $3,500 every 3 months or 1 month or 6 months or 9 months to take a teacher training. Let's start pumping out teachers. And then suddenly all these people are being pushed into the ether, many of whom are quite gifted and amazing. And it's a blessing that they got to go through that. I mean, I was one of them. I was trained in 2008. But then you have all these teachers, and suddenly the classes are starting to get dispersed a little bit. Then cut 20 years later to COVID, where a lot of the brick and mortar places got shut down, and the bigger studios that had the hold on those larger classes, a lot of them got disseminated, which is kind of cool and amazing. And now you've got a lot of smaller classes, and I feel like the ground has been leveled. And, you know, what is, again, success and popularity? It's not the same anymore. Now it's about reaching people much more authentically. We're entering this Aquarian age where it's less about like the guru sitting on the stage and like telling us what to do and, you know, being, I mean, it's a bummer because I know you like to teach at festivals and like being in a room of hundreds. There's something beautiful and magical. But I'm just not sure if that's going to be that's going to be the structure for now. For now, it feels like everything's gotten a lot more leveled. And no, we're not necessarily going to have classes of hundreds of people right now. We may again, and you may still where you are. I don't see that happening in New York, LA, anywhere in the US.
In the UK, it's definitely diluted now. And also, yeah. I think part of it is the finances. Like, let's say try yoga, for instance. So many yoga teachers would teach their classes in their studio, but then also have memberships of a bigger studio, like Try Yoga or, you know, equivalents in other cities. But now they simply can't afford that. You know, if they're full-time teachers, they're just going to go to the practice at the place where they get free classes.
Exactly.
End of. So the community has been almost kind of separated into lots of small communities now. And it's not the same as it used to be, where you would see all the same faces at workshops. But more people are doing yoga now, which is a wonderful thing. Yeah. And more people are integrating yoga into their life, which is great. There's a studio in London called More Yoga that tends to attract like newer teachers, like newly qualified teachers. And the teachers are also the receptionist and the cleaner. And they're in like quite often, sometimes like rundown buildings, not always. And just packing it in, but so popular, which is a nice thing to see.
And also, like, for people that don't know the history of Mati Israti, she started doing a work study. She went to a yoga class at like 5 p.m. on a Friday, fell in love, and then went to the front desk and said, "Can I please volunteer in order to take classes?" She was a ballet dancer. Mm-hmm. And it was there at the desk that she then went on to meet the other teachers that helped her, you know, fund the beginning of yoga work. So that was the model. Maybe we're getting back to it, right? That's what it sounds like. It's like we were all kind of, it was a little bit more grassroots and a lot more communal. One thing that comes to mind, and because I know you have a ton of yoga teachers and studio owners that listen to this, is consider making a deal for yoga teachers to come to your classes. I can't go to some of my friends' studios unless I'm willing to pay $35 a class. And I am, of course, I want to support them, but I can't go with the regularity that I used to. Mm-hmm. I can't go and practice with my own teacher because she's at a studio that's in the city that, like, for me to drive there and then spend the $40 and be away from the kids, and it's such a challenge. So if I can make any call to action for us, I also have amazing friends who have apps. Tara Stiles recently was like, she's like, just gave me a login, you know, and other studios are like, just come and practice. So if we can have some sort of understanding, and again, this isn't for everybody or anybody that just took a teacher training, but there should be like, we are all in this together. Mm. Remember that we're all a community. We shouldn't have to be sanctioned off. I would be going to so many other places if I had that flexibility. Mm.
to change direction a little bit, it says in, I think it's your bio, says that you are wanting to change the world one person at a time by teaching self-love to one person at a time. So I'm just wondering where that comes from, where that angle comes from, and what your journey personally with self-love is.
That's so funny. That's a very old bio.
Is it still true?
But it is. It is. I reword it a little differently. I mean, something, and a direction that I've been going recently is a little bit more towards maternal mental health advocacy. Mm-hmm. Not to leave the dads behind, but I don't live in a dad body. And by the way, dad body is going to get you more students, not less. Okay. It's about showing up as a real person. I meant to pull that thread earlier. So, the self-love of it all, I can't teach someone to love themselves. That's not my job. Mm-hmm. I used to think I could I would be like giving the homework assignment of affirmations. And then I'm like, and read this book and here's Louise Hay. And then like, come see me in the morning, don't you love yourself better now? But that's not something that I can teach, but I can facilitate the spaces for it. Mm-hmm. And how we can do that is by helping people connect to their big S self, right? To their most authentic self and to a higher power, mm-hmm. whatever that may be. You can call it universe or God or whatever. So recently I've been kind of traveling. It started with parents, and now I'm leaning a little bit more towards the mom side of things. And I'm focusing more on the self-care aspect of it, because that is something I can teach. It's mm-hmm. a tangible tool to help people access themselves. And I don't mean self-care like go take a bubble bath, like self-care like, get up a few minutes earlier than your kids and take deep breaths, that like different, be unapologetic when you do take that bubble bath kind of thing, so that there is more of the access towards that. But the self-love of it all, I think that's something we're all doing that has to happen in community and individually at the same time. It's a really mm-hmm. interesting experience in that mm-hmm. way.
I was just going to say, I think you write in your book about parenting and how mums, there's kind of this old paradigm of how mums should put everyone else first before themselves, and you're trying to rewrite that story and turn it the other way around, because essentially you can't give from an empty cup. So what's your journey been with kind of rewiring that narrative and putting yourself and your own needs first, and what impact has that had on your family?
Well, nobody likes the family system to be upset. I'll say that. Nobody is ever like, when you start setting boundaries for yourself and you're like, I need this time, your family's not going to be like, good for you. I mean, maybe like in a perfect dream situation, but you're both parents, we're tired. We're all spread too thin. Like we're all lacking the village of the, what mm-hmm. human beings and social creatures are meant to be raised in. So it is going to be met with a little bit of potential bristling from those around you. But it really is just like being clear on, I need to fill my cup in this way. I think of it all as like pre-gaming. I got to pre-game my self-care. I have to wake up before everybody, and you don't have to wake up before anybody to do it, but I have to do it before the blow up, if that makes sense. Yeah. Like I can't, like, and I just posted today about this too, about the myth of like, regulating your nervous system when your kid is like smacking you in the face. Like it's not, there's a reason that it's called a primal response. And so the work becomes, what are you doing beforehand so that you have a much wider window of tolerance? And what are you doing afterwards, after a disruption, so that you can return to your regulation and your calm? And what that's looked like for me personally as the mom, and I don't say primary parent because my husband is very, very involved, but like there's just a certain role as the mother. Mm. And also, like, I'm going to be fully honest, I'm a yoga teacher and a writer. Like, I'm not covering the roof over our head. I'm not the one who's like putting the food on the table right now. So if there's an issue, I'm the one who has to drop what I'm doing to go and take care of it. And that's, that's just the way it goes. But so what I've started to do is really ask for what I need mm-hmm. and do so like understanding, like, there's going to be like a logistical conversation. It may not be, wanting to get up and work out in the morning may not be met with like, good for you for taking care of yourself, but also knowing that like, I will be a better mom that day if I do that. So it's so much like the pre-gaming. It's the, I remember we had this conversation on our podcast, yeah. And Adam, I think you were talking about that, right? It's like the filling the battery, filling the tank beforehand, and then, you know, just being sure to keep doing that in whatever way you can. But yeah, it's an ongoing challenge.
And did you start to become more aware of this and want to help people through this as an issue due to your experience of being a parent? Like, was there a moment, like a month in, 2 months in, a year in, when you thought, oh my God, like I need this to be my work now?
So prior to meeting my husband, when I met you and I was running around the world and, you know, teaching workshops and working, and you guys know this, you both have had schedules like this where it was like 5 clients in a day and running around the entire city, and it was just all about the bottom line. I thought that I had good boundaries because I would say no to things like going on dates, going to my friends' birthday parties, weddings, things that were like joyful communal gatherings, I would turn down for job opportunities and think to myself, oh, I've got amazing boundaries. Mm. But what I realized is I had no boundaries when it came to work. I was saying yes to everything career related because it felt like it was in a locus of control. I mean, obviously nothing's in our control, but it felt like something I could control. It feels much more comfortable to stand in front of a room and tell people what to do than to like be on a date with some person I've never met before and like, you know, have to be myself, right? Or even be with friends I've known for 30 years. There's a vulnerability there that was hard for me. Mm-hmm. So the boundary question was always something I was working on. And then when I met my husband, I was starting to get a little softer, if you will. Like, you know, when we first met, I was a diehard Ashtanga practitioner. And I remember the first day morning I skipped practice because he'd slept over. Oh. And it was like, like waiting for the police to knock the door down and be like, how dare you skip your practice? You know, and that like, I was like, oh, I was okay. My body didn't fall apart. I still was able to do the poses that I thought were important 2 days later. And it just started slowly like that, little piece by piece. I do think it was not necessarily becoming a mom, but living in partnership that really started to show me where I needed to soften and where I needed to harden and just how backwards my boundaries were.
Yeah, I can relate to a lot of what you said there about, yeah, needing to be in control. I'm awesome when I'm in control of a situation. But I talked about on the last podcast, I was in an influencer event, like a high profile one, and I hated it because I had no control. And I was no one, as it were. Like I couldn't tell people to move their body. I wasn't presenting. I had to like mingle with people that were just naturally extroverted, and I'm the opposite. I hated it completely. And yeah, often, you know, work can feel like the safe thing, can't it? Doing more work, and you can easily justify doing more work. Oh, well, it's to provide, it's to build my future. But then suddenly you've missed your life.
Do you find
Sorry, you carry on. I was just going to say, like, I can see where mine began too. I mean, my father is an overachiever. It's in my bones and in my DNA. But when I went like full throttle into my career was after my mom died. Okay. And I was like, all right, that's it. Here's my heart. Going to close it up now. Like, nobody's getting in there, and I'm going to do everything I can. So that was there was for me a little bit of a spark. And as you both know, the second you have a baby, it's not even and no offense like to the husbands or the partners or the wives, but like it's the like you have a child and then suddenly like boom, your heart is cracked open and literally living outside of you, right? As I think Joe Didion said. But sorry.
Did you always want kids?
No, and I didn't want them at all.
Oh, wow.
And do you think, and I'd love to hear your views on this, there seems to be, and it could just be the bias of my Instagram algorithm, which weirdly, but it's changed to lots of Indian dancing lately. I don't know. I've been trying to speak to Instagram about why this is happening. All I'm seeing is Indian influencers dance. Anyway, but before that, my Instagram algorithm was lots of like, promoting not being a parent, as it were. Oh, my life is so cool because I'm not in a relationship and I don't have kids, and you know, I definitely never want kids, and lots of advocacy of basically don't become a parent because life is cooler without it. And I understand perhaps You know, for some people, I'm sure they don't want to be parents and life is indeed better without it. But I feel as well, lots of people are also kind of moving on with life and realizing at a later age, oh, maybe I should have tried to have kids, etc. And it could be kind of a justification of why I don't want, like a reflective justification of why not to have kids. And I just wondered what your thoughts are on that. Because I almost wonder, now being a parent, and you know, a parent of a 1.5-year-old, I kind of want to shout out on the rooftops, it's the best thing in the world. Aww. I can't describe the feeling of like having your little boy look in your eyes and giggle is just the best thing ever.
I'm crying a little bit, yeah.
I feel that like I can't shout that out because of course lots of people who would like kids can't have kids for various reasons, yeah, because of personal circumstance or medical stuff, etc. And also I feel like there'd be like blowback. But I feel really sad that it's part of like our society is moving away from like the nuclear family, as it were. And that's not a really cool thing to say. But being in our little nuclear family is just, it feels like so complete and so wonderful and magical. And so I just wonder what your thoughts are on that. Because I feel that, yeah, it's often in the wellness industry, this encouragement almost not to have children.
I wonder as you know, it's what I was going to have a different answer, at least a different path that I was going to take until you said the nuclear family thing, because I wonder if that's what's contributing. Because the reality is, we cannot survive as a nuclear family. It's impossible. You need a village to raise a child, right? And I don't know where your care circumstances are. I remember we did talk about having family here and having family there. But the idea of it just being the like parents and the children or child is actually unrealistic.
Can I ask you a quick question there? Like, maybe I misunderstand the nuclear family term. Because it's not something used in the UK. I thought it was just more a term that was used in kind of like potential Cold War era, where people were saying, actually, you need, you know, the promotion of the family unit. I didn't realize it was about separation from the outside. I thought it was just saying...
I thought it was just... But you could be right. I mean, maybe there's a different context, like being in a country where, you know, where it was affected by World War II and nuclear threat. My understanding was that it's the immediate family. The nuclear family is the immediate
family. So shall we say for this instance, we mean by nuclear...
but it's important because real quick, I don't want you to change it. Yeah. And I'm not correcting you because this is what I think is happening. So, you know, in communal societies and collectivist cultures and in tribal societies, everybody's living as one, right? It's like, it may be your baby, but like your friend that lives like down the street is also parenting. That's that allo-parenting relationship. Your aunt, your sister, everybody is involved in it, right? The dad, the brother. So everybody is very much integrated because the whole society thrives because everybody's together. Mm-hmm. In the West, and I mean capital W, like from parts of Europe on and over, and you know, it's actually all over the world now, just with like, you know, the spread of the influence. But is that this idea of you just need your immediate family. You don't need to be in a larger group. This is all about you and individualistic pursuits and you moving forward. And what do you need? And it becomes so separated from the unit that there's people that are seeing that the nuclear family is drowning because there is no village. And we're all like, we're exhausted. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the best moment of my life. But I'm like crying at the same time. And they're kind of leaning more towards that individualistic side of things where they're like, fuck it, you know, like, sorry, everybody there, but they're like, I'm just going to look out for myself in all of this, because I do wonder, like, you know, if it was a tribal culture, if it was a collectivist culture, would we have as many of those people making those decisions? You have aesthetics, right? You have like, for example, in India and the, different stages of life. You have people that are students and then they choose to go and become spiritual seekers. They skip the whole household stage. But are there people that are just saying like, forget you, I'm just going to go and work for myself and take care of myself? That I don't know. And that I wonder sometimes if it's not just a byproduct of being in places where there are systems that are not supporting families. Everybody sees we're drowning. I mean, it is the most amazing thing, and I would would hope that people could have as much of a heart-opening experience in whatever way that they're, however it happens, whether it's a dog, a plant, a cat, or a kid, that there is to what we're experiencing. But we're all kind of also drowning at the same time, right? Like, I mean, at least here in the United States, and I don't know what sort of services the UK has to support parents, but they're like, you have the kid and you're out and they're like, okay, see ya.
Yeah.
No paid family leave. Completely unaffordable childcare.
Yeah,
so all these single people are looking around, or people that are partnered, but you know, and they're like, "Oh, I don't want to do that." Mm. You know, so it just becomes more. It kind of goes the opposite way of where we should be going. So I don't know.
Do you think as well, like this factor of, I don't like other people's kids that much, particularly, and if my knowledge of being a parent was based on how much I like other people's children, I definitely wouldn't want to be a parent. Mm. But I really like my kid.
Yeah.
And my love for that kid is... Mm. So that's perhaps a factor as well, is people think, well, I don't like Jack's child. He's a brat. And of course, you only see Jack's child when you're out at a dinner and they're like on their phone or just being annoying. That might be a factor.
What's your experience been with your children? Have you felt the lack of the village around you, given everything that you were saying, or have you had the support? Or yeah, what's it been like for you?
Yeah, so I mean, as mentioned, I kind of came into it as with a deficit because my mom passed away almost 15 years ago. So I don't have my mom nearby. My dad lives in Toronto with my stepmom, nowhere near us. My sister is single and lives around here, but she's completely sucked into the work of it all. She's a teacher and unavailable. She needs a village, right? Mm-hmm. And then my brother has his kids and he's got a preschooler too, and they're sucked into their own thing. So we're like unable to support each other in that way. Now, I was very blessed to find this neighborhood where a number of us, and this is, I think, again, one of the beauties of the pandemic, is a lot of people left the cities to move to the outskirts, mm-hmm. the suburbs, if you will. And a bunch of us moved into this one neighborhood at the same time, and we all had boys that were the same ages. Aww. And so we have now been together. We've been here we're coming up on 4 years, and we've raised each other's kids. We've been with each other through this thick and thin. And there really is a village mentality. And I know when the kids get older, it really will be like one will run out the door and go to the other person's house, and that idea of allo-parenting. And it's funny that you say that, Adam, because I went to LA to visit some friends that I hadn't seen since I became a mom. And she was like, you hated kids. Like, you would talk about how dirty they were and how much they smell and how sticky they are. And I was like, I still feel that way. I do. But I actually don't feel that way about these kids. I feel that way about like random kids. But like these kids almost feel like family to me. I love them with my whole heart. And I know that they love my kids in the same way. So we are creating the village. And then I'm starting a mom's group that's going to be starting tomorrow, that's in person. Like, I'm like, let's build this village. If it's not there, let's create it. And I think we can cobble it together. It's just going to look a little bit untraditional.
And I read that you created this group. You wanted it to be, did you say, judgment-free and compassion-full? So have you had personal experience of feeling judged as a mum, which inspired you to kind of create the group? Or can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think parents are like set up for failure in a lot of ways. I think women in particular, with the ideal parent. And again, it's like the ideal worker, the ideal producer, right? This like these perfectionistic images that were fed on Instagram, so that when we have these very real experiences, all of us feel like we're failing. And there can be judgment. There can even be judgment from the people you love most, right? Mm-hmm. In-laws and parents can be like, why are you parenting in this way? And that can just be like the most simple things of being judged on, like, you know, giving your kid a choice over what cup they're going to use, or, you know, asking them to wake them up instead of letting them nap for long hours. So yes, I think there is a lot of judgment around us. I do find that when we are in circle and when it's parents together and like these village settings, that you can really show up and be yourself. Mm-hmm. But it has to be a safe space for that, because you don't know how people are going to judge. And I'm dancing around the issue, so I'm just going to say it. So we had a chosen loss a couple of months ago. We got pregnant again, and I had a very, very, very difficult pregnancy with my second. Mm. And there are many, many reasons why. Like, I was quite sick, and there's a whole host that we can't do that right now. And it was horribly isolating and really scary, and just, it was something that I wanted to talk about, and I wanted to talk to other parents. I wanted to talk to other parents, but I'm terrified of what people's beliefs are around abortion, where, you know, how are people going to accept you in that moment? What are people's politics? Mm-hmm. So in creating this circle, I want it to be a politics-free, religion-free, this just very neutral zone where we're just showing up as human beings and we're holding the space for each other in a non-judgmental and accepting way.
Mm. That's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Has this community started yet? Have you? Are people
tomorrow's
coming?
Our first day.
And do you know who's coming to it?
I do. I know half of them, and then the other half I don't know. So I'm very excited to meet the new people. And I've had a lot of interest with people that don't live here. So I'm like, okay, maybe we'll do this virtually. Like, that's my vision. Is just, you know, I just want to hold space. I think about you all the time, Adam, because you said in our podcast that, like, teachers who aren't teaching public classes, like, you kind of lose your, I don't know what it is. Like, you're not seeing bodies, right? You're not, like, in there. And I'm not in the studios in that way. I'm not right now. I still consider myself a yoga teacher, but this is a different way for me to teach that feels like something I could do the rest of my life. Like, it doesn't matter if my shoulder's blown out. Mm. It doesn't matter if I'm, you know, exhausted. I can show up exactly as I am. I can just be in circle with people. And that's just been, it's so lovely. I'm so excited for more of that.
And you can still be a yoga teacher and not teach asana, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And how do you intend to actually have a play for how you're going to deal with, like, someone that might bring their political views into it? Like, I guess teaching teacher trainings is pretty good experience, kind of balancing strong personalities. What's your tactics, or what might be your tactics?
I think it starts on day one, right? And it does. And thank goodness I've led as many teacher trainings as I had, because I wouldn't be brave enough to be able to hold a circle. And I've had it all. I've had, oh my gosh, like, you know, we will not give examples, but let's just say
for it if you want
that
to.
I led a retreat in 2017 in America. So, you know, there was a lot of misunderstanding on there. And so day one, you have to set it up that, like, again, you just keep saying this is judgment-free and compassionful. And we're going to ask that our outside beliefs are kept outside of here. And let's just focus directly on ourselves and our experience of, at that point, it was yoga. And this will be of motherhood. But it's a very real possibility. I mean, I also, like, let's talk about the reality of living in the Bay Area, where in California, where, like, it's unlikely I will be coming up against people that, you know, you're very much in a bubble, right, in certain parts of the world. So I invite people with different views. I love that, and I want to be challenged. But yeah, I mean, I think it really, it's so much like when you're holding a circle in teacher training, and you have to, like, cut someone off that's talking really fast, or you have to, like, you're either talking too long, rather, or you have to, like, actually take them aside and ask them to leave that stuff out. But I think day one, you just say, like, out political affiliations, religious affiliations, we're going to leave all of that on the side, and let's just show up as human beings, and in this case, as mothers.
Mm. That's lovely. Well, good luck. I hope it goes amazing.
I'll be messaging you guys tomorrow, like, holy.
let's chat about your book now.
Yeah.
So how does yoga, so there is a whole cliche of, oh, you know, you become, your real yoga practice starts when you become a parent. And I think maybe even on our podcast together, previously we chatted about the idea of a formal and informal practice. But how does yoga influence parenting, or vice versa? Or how do we practice yoga as a parent, or how do we parent from yoga perspectives?
I think I wouldn't have necessarily titled it the yoga of parenting anymore. Originally my original title was The Perfectly Imperfect Parent, and I still like stand by that.
I like that.
That's a
yeah.
good title. Because I feel like yoga of parenting is redundant. If we go back to just the origin of the word itself, right? Yoga, and we look at in the Sanskrit language how yoga actually is not just asana, right? Yoga is a word that's like lowercase y yoga that's used for many different definitions. It describes an astrological conjunction. I can speak. It describes a mathematical sum. It describes a wedding. There's like the word yoga is used sometimes for wedding. Mm. It describes the act of putting an arrow into a bowstring. Mm. And all of these things, if you look at them from, and that's just the Sanskrit language. Like there's just, it's one word that means all these different things. It covers all these different areas. So when you look at it from like a high level view, I'm like, you know, I don't know about you guys, but like, I'm like, oh, this is all connection. Everything is about connection, coming together. Even there's one, yoga is sometimes used as to describe putting together a con job, which I think is hilarious and amazing. And I don't know how many people, a con job, like a bank robbery or something.
Oh.
And I'm like, how many people, I don't know how often or frequently that was going on, but, And the source for this, by the way, is Lauren Roche's Radiant Sutras is an amazing book. And he talks all about this. But if you look at it from above, right, this like the nucleus of yoga, it's all really connection. And then when we look at the capital Y yoga, like the actual studies of Vedanta and yoga philosophy, whether it's connection to body, which is, you know, one modality, or connection to self, or connection to this, the long and short is that it's all about connection. So parenting is connection, right? I mean, from, if you have the privilege of growing a child inside of you, then that's a deep connection to when they are newborns, to toddlers, to as they get older and older. So to me, it was like a no-brainer. I mean, this is connection. Any deep relationship is connection, and therefore is yoga. Mm.
Did you find a deeper connection with yourself on becoming a parent, and what did that look like?
Yeah, I feel like I almost am more myself now than I was prior. Mm. Like I almost had to like really lose myself in the beginning stages of motherhood, where I didn't know what was up and what was down, to start to get clearer and clearer and clearer on what I need. And I think I credit my yoga practice, my asana practice, for that, because much in the same way that when you do something and it doesn't feel right in your body and you let your body, you know, regroup, or you're willing to bring in support and you're willing to bring in props to find the place that feels good. A lot of what I was doing in early parenting days, where I was like giving up all of my time and, you know, not taking care of myself and just completely lost in the perfection of it all, that it not feeling correct in my body slowly guided me towards a place where I can start to feel more in line with myself. And I still feel like I'm drowning on most days, but it's much more, I can see what I need underneath that, right? Mm-hmm. It's much clearer now, but it had to come from making mistakes, if you will. It had to come from drowning ultimately to figure out what I needed to get my head above water.
Mm. I love that.
I love it. And then, so let's get a little bit more deep into the book. So what can people expect from the book? Like, we've got a copy at home, but just for our listeners. So what is the, describe it. Is it tips? Is it philosophy?
It's a mix. It's a little bit of everything, because I think everything is holistic and you can't just like deal with one thing. Everything is interconnected. So every chapter, there's 10 concepts. Every chapter has a pose to support the concept. Then it talks about the concept, right? Like boundaries, energy management, using challenges to fortify us, resiliency. And then within there, we have backup peer-reviewed research. So like modern brain research, psychology articles, all that back up these concepts that were originated from the wisdom texts, right? They were things that we've been talking about for thousands of years, but now we actually have the science to back it up. And then it ends with a very short, very accessible tool or tip or lesson for the parent to take away. So something, there's either meditations, or there's one that's like just an observational practice where you literally just like watch your kids for 20 minutes. And just, so this is the practice of non-attachment, like not stepping in, not getting involved, which is, you know, can be very challenging for some parents, especially those of us that like to control. So just, and yeah, and then there's 10 in total, and it all comes together at the end. You can weave the poses together to make a little sequence, so you can practice it and go through all those many stages and the ups and downs that is parenting. I wanted it to be a really accessible guide and not something you necessarily need to go through chapter one to chapter two, chapter three. It's, you can flip open and find the lesson that works for you, like a tarot card.
You mentioned before, actually, I just came to mind that one of the meanings of yoga with lowercase y is to like put an arrow in a bow. And it just reminded me of, do you know the writer Kahil Gibran?
Mm-hmm.
Part one thing he said about parenting is that you are an archer and you put your child in a bow. You can pull it back as far as you can. You can give the best start in life. And all you can do is give it some vague direction. You can't control where it will land, how far it will go. But you... with love, he didn't add that, maybe he did in a loose way, but with love, you just give it some vague direction. And I really like that idea.
That's beautiful. And he also wrote on parenting, right, which was part of the prophet, which I quote in the book, which he talks about that our children are not ours.
Yes.
Like that the prophet is those series of poems. And when he's talking about on children, he's saying like, that was, I mean, I think that's a really hard lesson for parents too. And that's exactly what you're saying, right? It's like we have the influence in the beginning, but then at a certain point we send them out in the world and, you know, it's just like, that's the non-attachment of it, right? Like I always like rub my hands together, throw my hands up. I feel like that's very symbolic of that.
My friend says that you borrow your children for a time and then you have to let them go. That's terrifying, that thought. I don't want to think about it.
Well, it's really sad that you spend something like 90% of the time you ever will with your parents by the time their kids are 18 or by the time you're 18 or more. It could even be more than 90%. Anyway, let's not talk about that. Suddenly stand there.
So perhaps,
now we're all crying.
I know. Perhaps you could leave us with maybe... Share one of the tips from your book, maybe for a parent that's listening who is struggling and feeling like just like they're having a meltdown. What would be your number one in the book if they could just do one for now?
So if they're having a meltdown, like we're not going to deal with that part right now. Like just like be graceful for yourself. It's all good. We're all human. Like that's my number one tip is like, whew, you just like survive. But then when things have settled, pay attention throughout the day at the times of the day where you feel like your tank is being filled and the times of the day where you feel like you're being depleted. And just paying attention to that. And maybe you can write it down at the end of the day, which I know feels like an additional task. But when you just start to notice, like, you know, and we can talk about it from a nervous system perspective or from a pranic perspective, which, you know, you could argue is just the tangible for that. Is like, just notice, right? Like, when are you feeling uplifted and light? And when are you feeling bogged down and heavy? And if there are things that you can control that are the bogged down and heavy, like maybe it's a scheduling thing, or maybe it's a matter of like needing that few minutes to breathe. Something we've been doing recently is, you know, getting out the doors. Like, I got these two wild kids. I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old that are like monkeys. They're like, this one's over here and this one's over here. And then, you know, you're rushing and you got to go. And so when we get in the car, right before we pull out, we all take a deep breath. And that's a very grounding. That's like, I go from feeling bogged down or heightened or whatever in the moment to settling. So it's finding more of those moments and then seeing if you can weave them in, even if it's just one thing a day that you noticed the day before was a light moment and an energizing moment. Do that again the next day and just maybe do it twice.
Yeah, it's so simple as well. So accessible, isn't it? Mm. Thank you so much.
And so where can people find you?
Thank you guys.
And your books and your courses?
Plug away.
Yeah. So thank you. My book is available wherever books are sold. It is on, you know, Amazon, Audible, wherever you get your books. And then I also have a course, a yoga of parenting course through Meditation University. That's a part of Meditation Magazine, which is just all these short little practices that are very specific to parents. And then I'm probably most active on Instagram, but there's also my website. And if you sign up for my website, you get a free meditation, and always good to connect there. So many places, I'm everywhere and nowhere all at the same time. And just always glad to meet new people and connect. It's my favorite part of what we do.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Balance.